As quickly as they'd brought her in, she was being shown out. "It wasn't a burden," she managed to reply. Weeks of traveling, sitting in the Treasury's records room, combing through files, studying ledgers and reports until her eyes ached and it was dark outside. She could feel the weight of Hilo's stare following her as she stood up and went out the door. "Shay," Lon said. She paused with a hand on the door, and he said in a gentler voice, "Come for dinner at the house sometimes, whenever you want. No need to call ahead." Shay nodded without turning and let herself out. The heavy door clicked shut behind her. She leaned against it and shut her eyes for a moment, fighting down the same bewildering mixture of emotions she'd sat with in the taxi this morning. Why was she so upset about being dismissed when a few minutes ago she hadn't wanted to be in the room in the first place? She felt like slapping herself hard across both sides of the face. You can't have it both ways. It was well that Lon had made her go. With shame, she admitted her grandfather was right after all. She didn't know who she was anymore. Chapter 22. Honor, Life, and Jade. Once the door closed behind Shay, Lon said to Hilo, "Have someone you trust watch Doru. Someone with little enough jade that he won't notice. You have a nose in the weatherman's office?" When Hilo nodded, Lon said, "I want to know if he's had any contact with the mountain. If he's really a traitor."
"Seems we could bring him in here and find out pretty quick right now."
Lon shook his head.
"What if we're wrong? Then again, what if we're right? Doru is like a brother to Granda. He's the only one Granda has left from his glory days. You haven't seen them together every morning, those two."
"I have. They still drink their tea and play circle chess under the cherry tree in the courtyard, like an old married couple. It would kill the old man to see Doru accused of treason."
Lon closed his eyes for a moment, then opened them again.
"No," he said. "We have to know for sure, and if it's true, we have to handle it quietly, so Granda never knows."
"Doru will suspect we're on to him," Hilo said,
"and everyone else will ask questions. How are you going to explain the fact that we shut him out just now?"
"I'll smooth it over," Lon said.
"I'll say we were talking privately with Shay, brother to sister, trying to convince her to come back into the clan."
Hilo sat down finally in the seat Shay had vacated. Lon had to edge back in his own chair slightly. With new jade in his hand and in his pocket, Hilo's aura seemed too bright in his mind.
"What about Shay?" Hilo asked.
"What about her?"
"You told me not to push her. You said we're to leave her alone and let her walk around embarrassing herself with no jade on, if that's what she wants to do."
"That's right," said Lon.
"Then you send her to dig into clan business. You didn't even tell me. If I'd have known she was working for you, I would have been nicer to her."
Hilo tilted his head.
"Don't get me wrong, I'm not disagreeing, but which is it? You want her in or out?"
Lon exhaled slowly through his nose. "I wouldn't have asked her to do anything for the clan, but I needed someone with a brain for numbers, someone not in Doru's control to follow my suspicions. Considering what she found, I don't regret it, but it doesn't mean I've changed my mind."
"You're gonna need a new weatherman soon," Hilo pointed out.
"No," said Lon, sharply now. "If she decides she wants in, that's one thing. I'm not going to guilt, order, or threaten her back into the clan. She especially doesn't need any pressure from you. She gets enough from Granda as it is. Shay has an Aspenian education now, something neither of us has, so she has other options in life that we don't.
Jonlun's not just for greenbones. You can choose to live without jade, an ordinary citizen with an ordinary life, like millions of other people."
Hilo held his hands up.
"All right.
You're not kids anymore. The two of you can make your own choices. I don't need to wipe bloody noses and tell you to show some respect to each other."
"I said all right."
A moment of silence passed before Hilo said, "Lan, I didn't notice until I was sitting closer to you, but your aura doesn't seem right. It's..."
He squeezed his eyes shut and turned his face aside, concentrating his perception.
"It's flaring, pulsing, kind of. It feels off. Not like you."
"It's all the new jade," Lan said.
"It's taking a little getting used to. You know how it is."
He was sitting still, but his heart was beating fast. Hilo opened his eyes.
"I don't think you should wear it."
"I won this jade." Lan was startled by his sudden defensiveness.
"It's mine by right. You wear all the jade you've won, don't you?"
His brother shrugged.
"Sure. What did you take last night?"
Hilo leaned back and shifted his hip off the chair so he could reach into his pockets and pull out his spoils.
"The rings, bracelet, and pendant. I'll get them reset, obviously."
He held them out for Lan's inspection.
"The watch and these studs belong to the makes. There's a belt in my car that's theirs by right, too."
He returned them to his pockets and sat back.
"It's not as much as Gom's."
"You still have more overall." Lan blinked. Had he just said that? Hilo's eyes widened, surprised as well.
"Is that what this is about?"
He ran his tongue over his lips.
"I'm the horn, brother. People don't expect me to be smart. They do expect me to carry a shitload of jade. Everyone's different.
Some people are better,
thicker-blooded."
Lan wondered what was wrong with him, that he was sounding so bitter and testy. The fatigue from staying up for more than 36 hours straight, the fight in front of the factory, and now the jade, it was all getting to him. Too much, too quickly.
"It's been years since I've dueled, Hilo," he said.
"Ait killed her father's own horn and two of his fists. Today I had to fight in front of our men, and I had to win. Tomorrow, people will be paying attention to see if I'm wearing the proof that I'm thick-blooded enough for No Peak to stand up to the mountain in a war. You know better than anyone that it's true."
Hilo's gaze was straight. "You're right. It's true."
He glanced down at the carpet, lips pursed, then back up again.
"You don't have to do it right now, though. After what Gom hit you with, you're hurt. Put it down, Lan. Give yourself a break."
He got up and held his hand out, offering to take it. In a surge of possessiveness, Lan's fist tightened around the jade. His jade. How dare his little brother think to take it from him? Hilo's aura was too harsh and close, mentally blinding. He kept standing there, though, hand extended, and Lan perceived no greed, only concern. In a burst of clarity, he knew the jade was doing this, setting him on edge, skewing his emotions. He'd been taught the early warning signs of jade overexposure since he was a child. Every greenbone had. Severe mood swings, sensory distortion, shaking, sweating, fever, a racing heart, anxiety, and paranoia. The appearance of symptoms could be sudden or gradual. They might come and go for months or years, but were exacerbated by stress, poor health, or injury. If left unaddressed, they could progress into the itches, which were almost always fatal. Hilo was looking at him intently now. Lan forced himself to open his hand and set the jade studs on the side table. He removed the chokers from his breast pocket and pushed all of Gom's jade away from himself. A few seconds passed before the change kicked in, and then it was dramatic, as if a high fever had suddenly broken. His heart rate came down. The painful sharpness of the room receded. Hilo's aura returned to its usual smooth hum. Lan took a slow, deep breath and let it out again, trying not to let his relief appear too palpable. "Better?" Hilo nodded and sat back down, but there was an uncertainty in his eyes that Lan did not like. So even Hilo doubted his ability.
Kal Sen was a decrepit old man. Doru might be a traitor,
and Shay refused to even wear jade. It was only him and Hilo now. What was happening to the Great Call family?
"You should go, Hilo," he said. "We both have things we need to do."
His brother did not move from the chair.
"I've something else to ask you," he said. Lon had almost never seen his brother look nervous, but now Hilo rubbed his hands together and cleared his throat.
"I want to marry Wen."
Lon tried not to sigh out loud.
"Do we have to talk about this right now?"
"Yes." Hilo's voice took on sudden urgency. "After last night, I don't want to waste time, Lon. I don't want to be lying on the pavement bleeding out the last seconds of my life thinking I didn't do everything I meant to, that I didn't give her this one thing when I had the chance."
Lon's head ached, and he felt dehydrated. The dramatic addition and then withdrawal of jade made him feel as if his skull had been pulled out too far and then squeezed back down too tightly. He rubbed his brow.
"You really love her."
To his surprise, Hilo looked insulted.
"Why would I be asking otherwise?"
Lon felt like telling him that love wasn't enough, not when it came to marriage. There was a time when he thought it would be enough. Amy had thought so too. She'd known he would one day be Pillar. She'd assured him she understood what that meant, that everything would work out fine in the end, because they loved each other. He'd convinced her, and himself, that taking on the leadership of No Peak wouldn't change him, wouldn't change things between them. They'd been wrong, of course. Looking back, Lon could see now that there'd been cracks beforehand, but the demands of the clan had shaken those cracks into impassable fissures. Warnings about the impermanence of love would not work on Hilo, though. He was not the sort of person who would ever view something so important to him in such an abstracted fashion.
"You know how I feel about Wen," Lon said. "She's a lovely girl. She's always been respectful to the clan, and I'd gladly treat her like my sister. But her family is beneath you.
Everyone knows the Makes were disgraced. A lot of people in No Peak still think they can't be trusted, and even if they don't say it out loud, they assume Wen is illegitimate." Hilo's neck flushed and his face grew stiff.
"All that happened years ago. You shouldn't blame the Makes for their parents. I made Kenan Tar my first and second fists. I wouldn't have done that if I didn't trust them with my life. And I don't care who Wen's father really is. She's of the No Peak clan as far as anyone is concerned, and she's a good person, caring and loyal."
"I'm sure she is," Lon said. "She's also a Stone Eye. There are always going to be people who see her as bad luck, or whisper she was born that way because she's a bastard and a punishment to her parents. Don't look so angry at me. I'm only telling you that the clan can have long and superstitious memories. You're the Horn. You have to think about that."
"I don't care what anyone else in the clan thinks. It's you I'm asking."
Hilo sounded almost desperate.
"You're willing to forgive Shay completely and welcome her back, but you balk at accepting the Makes?"
"That's different," Lon said. "Shay is a call no matter what. You're making the decision to bind our family to a disreputable name and to father children with a Stone Eye wife."
Hilo's aura roiled with tension. "What can I say to convince you?"
His eyes fastened to Lon's.
"I swear I'll never ask you for anything else."
Sometimes it astounded Lon that his younger brother could be so different from him. Short-sighted, yes, but fully committed. Passionate in a way that left so little room for doubt. Lon said,
"You've already made up your mind. I've said my concerns, but it's your decision, Hilo. You don't need my permission."
"Don't say that," Hilo snapped. "That's a bullshit excuse." He leaned so far forward in his chair that he half rose from it.
"You're my older brother. You're the Pillar. When Grandad was Pillar, he didn't let a leaf drop in the courtyard without his permission. People came to him to approve their marriages, their new businesses, the names of their kids and dogs, the color of their fucking wallpaper for all I know. Give me your blessing or condemn me, but don't wash your hands of me. It wouldn't mean anything for me to marry Wen without the approval of the pillar. No one would take it seriously. On the other hand, if Lan endorsed the union, he would be publicly forgiving the Make family. He would be sending the message that their past betrayal had been wiped clean. The Makes would be elevated to the right hand of the Calls. Other families would be jealous and angry. If he did not give his permission, however, he would hurt Hilo, and Hilo could be dramatically hurt. He would damage the relationship with his brother and his horn at a time when the clan could not afford any further weakness in the family. Lan's arms and legs felt heavy enough to sink him straight through the cushioned chair. It seemed everything in the clan required a decision from him that would invariably hurt or offend others and cause further problems. Looking at Hilo's face, though, he realized he couldn't find it in himself to refuse his brother's request. Even if he'd known how things would turn out with Amy, would he never have taken a gamble on overcoming the odds? He didn't think he could say so. As for Hilo and Wen, all the objections Lan had voiced, past sins, clan politics, superstition, they didn't touch those few seconds last night in the Lilac Divine when Make Ken had answered the pillar's unspoken panic with, "He's alive. He's fine." And Lan had understood, as he gripped the doorframe, that he wasn't ready to be a wartime pillar. He wasn't equipped to handle that kind of violent loss in his own family. "You're right, Hilo. It's better to think about today when tomorrow might not happen." "I give you my blessing to marry Make Wen," Lan said. He did his best to sound as sincere and positive as such a statement warranted. "Set a date. As soon as you want." Hilo left the chair and knelt on the carpet. He raised clasped hands to his forehead. "The clan is my blood, and the pillar is its master," Hilo said, reciting the ceremonial Greenbone clan oaths they'd both taken years ago. "Should I ever be disloyal to my brother, may I die by the blade. Should I ever fail to come to the aid of my brother, may I die by the blade. Should I ever seek personal gain at the expense of my brother, may I die by the blade." He bowed low, touching his forehead to the carpet. "On my honor, my life, and my jade." Lan wanted to protest the overly dramatic display of gratitude, but when Hilo straightened up, he was smiling his open, easy smile, the one that suggested he was not worried, and no one else need be either, and all was as it should be. He didn't look like someone who'd been through the same day as Lan had. Hilo got off the floor, gathered his weapons off the desk, and rested a hand on Lan's shoulder as he left the room. He pointed at the pile of Gom's jade. "Get some sleep before you try putting it back on."
Chapter 23. Autumn Festival Gifts. The wind howled and needles of rain hit the back of Barrow's neck as he hefted the last of the boxes into the van and clambered in after it. The other boy, who they called Cheeky, yanked the back doors shut.
"Go! Go!"
Barrow shouted at the driver. The van squealed into motion, throwing Barrow against the wall of the vehicle. He crawled up and around the containers packed with cartons of expensive brand-name wallets, shoes, handbags, and belts, and squeezed through the middle of the van into the passenger side seat. He stuck his head out the window to look behind them. The truck driver was still lying on his stomach under his semi-trailer with his hands over his head. There was no sign of pursuit. Pulling his head back into the van, Barrow rolled up the window and relaxed a little, then more so once the van hit the KI-1 freeway, speeding southward away from the docks. The rain picked up, splattering the windshield as fast as the noisy wipers could handle. Through the shimmery glare of water, The lights of the other cars in the road were bright red splotches, like autumn festival lamps. Barrow shoved the pistol more securely into the waistband of his pants and whooped as he punched the van's ceiling.
That was cut, KKs!
The entire operation had taken less than 5 minutes. Speed and planning were the key to a successful lift. Security was tight, and mistakes were deadly. Armed guards protected the ships, and Greenbones patrolled the docks. The best approach was to hijack trailer trucks once they had been loaded, but before they entered the motorway. Barrow was new at this game, but he was a quick study and hungry for work. This was his third successful lift in as many weeks. That pleased Moot, which in turn pleased the people behind Moot, people Barrow very much wanted to meet. The driver of the van, an untalkative man named Toss, who had bad skin and only ever wore black t-shirts, pulled the van off the freeway into the south part of Junco. He drove into the alley behind the Goody Two discount store and backed up to the open garage door. Moot came out to inspect the goods. He grunted in satisfaction and counted out payment on top of a second-hand pool table, while Cheeky unloaded the merchandise with the help of Moot's teenage son.
"You have to be more careful now," Moot said, throwing in an extra bit of cash for each of them. "The clans are going at each other."
Clan war was both an opportunity and danger. Greenbones busy fighting each other were less vigilant against thieves and smugglers, but they made up for the lapse by being more merciless to those they caught, especially any with possible ties to enemy clans.
"You got more tips for us?"
Barrow asked, zipping the money into the inside pocket of his jacket. A gust of strong wind rattled the half-open garage door. Moot pulled a folded manila envelope from his back pocket and held it out to Toss. The man shook his head.
"I'm out."
"You're out?"
Barrow exclaimed.
"After that kind of a lift?"
Toss grumbled.
"Not ready to die yet. Gonna quit while I'm ahead."
He jerked his chin at Barrow.
"Give it to him."
Toss walked back to the van. Moot didn't even watch Toss go. He passed the envelope to Barrow, who opened it and glanced inside quickly. Several sheets of paper stapled together. A list of JK Trucking Company's schedule in and out of Summer Harbor for the next 60 days. He smiled, impressed at Moot's access to such useful information. He stowed it inside his jacket next to the cash. A blast of rain blew into the garage, drenching the concrete floor, shaking box flaps and loose items.
"Hey!"
Moot shouted at his son.
"Close that door before we drown here, then go back out front and start taping up the windows. Yofo's in a fucking mood. Typhoon's coming, tomorrow or the day after for sure."
He ran a hand through his damp, wiry hair. His sleeve fell a few inches down his forearm, and Barrow glimpsed needle track marks on the inside of the man's wrists. Moot motioned Cheeky over, then said to both him and Barrow in a conspiratorial voice,
"You boys have been doing good. So good that someone wants to meet you. Maybe move you up. Give you some more work. You cut with that?"
"Yeah, I'm cut,"
Barrow said. Cheeky gave a nervous sniff, but nodded.
"I thought so."
Moot turned toward the store.
"Let's go then."
"He's here right now?"
Barrow asked.
"Right here, right now,"
Moot sang out, jovial, gesturing for them to follow him.
"Today's your lucky night, KKs."
They walked through the inside garage door to the front of the store. It was long past closing time, and the place was locked up. One strip of fluorescent lighting was turned on near the back, illuminating racks of sunglasses and bins of plastic sandals near the entrance to the restrooms. Shadowy aisles stretched away into the rest of the building. The only other two people inside were Moot's son, who was unrolling blue masking tape in large X's across the windows, and a man sitting in the dark on the cash register counter, a duffel bag on the ground below his feet. Moot walked Barrow and Cheeky over to the man and brought his hands up to his forehead in salute.
"These are the guys I told you about," Moot said. "One of them wasn't hungry enough and bailed out, so it's just the two of them now."
The man hopped off the table. He was a greenbone with a short goatee, jade bolts through his ears, and a jade ring in his nose. He wore a long forest green rain slicker over dark clothes and boots. He looked Barrow and Cheeky over with mild interest, the hollows of his eyes shadowed.
"What are your names?"
Barrow told him, then raised clasped hands.
"And what do we call you, Jen?" "You don't call me anything," said the greenbone. "I don't know you and you don't know me. This is no peak territory. So if you're caught by any of Call's men and they torture the shit out of you, you won't be screaming my name."
At the boy's silence, a smile curved the man's mouth.
"Does that frighten you? If it does, you might want to consider stepping back out that door the way you came." "You're not frightened," said Cheeky, not altogether convincingly. "I want what Moot has," Barrow said. "Just tell me how to get it."
The greenbone gave a knowing nod.
"Jade fever's a bitch, isn't it? If you've got your hands on a piece of green right now, without any training or some quality shine, you'd give off an aura like a fucking fire alarm. The first greenbone to come anywhere near you would know you for a thief and kill you in 3 seconds flat."
The man paused, tugging lightly on his goatee.
"Now Moot here is a special case. See, he's a friend of the clan. He tells us things we need to know. He does work for us in places we can't be. We appreciate that, so we take care of him. He has, let's call it, associate status. You could have that too, if you prove yourself to the clan."
The boys nodded.
"Good. Greenbones take jade from the bodies of their enemies, so if you're going to be a warrior, you'll need weapons."
The goateed greenbone knelt and unzipped the duffel bag at his feet. He withdrew a Fullerton C-55 submachine gun. He handed it to Barrow, then pulled out a second one and gave it to Cheeky. Barrow felt the weight of the thing in his hands and sucked in a breath. He'd never owned anything bigger than a pocket-sized pistol and couldn't believe his luck. He felt as if he were holding a baby. He didn't know where to put his hands, how to properly cradle such a valuable object.
"Shit, this is for real? You're giving these to us?" "Happy Autumn Festival," said the man. "You'd better practice a whole lot before I send you to use them. Moot will show you how."
The greenbone rose deadly fast and wrapped a hand around each of the boys' throats. With no time to move or gasp, they froze. With his strength, he could tear out their windpipes.
"If I hear that you held up a gas station or shot any bystanders, I'll break all your bones, and then your necks. You work for me now, you understand?"
The boys nodded, and he released them, giving them each a reassuring pat.
"For the time being, learn to use those things. Keep pulling the lifts at the docks that Moot's been setting you up with. Keep your eyes and ears open and don't get caught. When I need you, I'll let you know, and I'll expect you to be ready. You cut?"
"We're cut, Jen," Barrow said.
Outside, the wind had picked up. The silhouettes of trees whipped back and forth under the swaying streetlights. The roof of the building shook and creaked. Moot's son had finished taping the windows and disappeared into the back room. The goateed greenbone slung his duffel bag over his shoulder.
"Best be going.
The neighborhood and the weather aren't so friendly. Moot, good doing business with you, as usual. He extended to Moot the final item he'd brought out from the bag, an unmarked white cardboard container the size of a small shoebox, sealed with packing tape. Moot reached for it eagerly, but the green bone pulled it back at the last second, holding it just out of reach. His voice lowered, treading a line between friendly concern and unmistakable threat. Are you following the rules, Moot? Same dose every day, no hoarding or reselling. When Moot nodded vehemently, the green bone handed him the box and smiled. Always important to have safety reminders. Thank you, Jen, Moot murmured, his relief palpable. The green bone lifted the hood of his rain slicker over his head. His boots clomped down the dark center aisle of the goody two. He turned the lock, opened the door, and walked out into the approaching typhoon. Chapter 24. After the Typhoon. Typhoon Loco hit Kaycon 2 days before the autumn festival, as if Yofo the Unforgiving had awoken in time to meet the end-of-season deadline. In Jeonmun, businesses and schools closed as residents hunkered inside, wadding towels around their windows and doors as savage winds and torrential rain pounded the east coast of the island. Red lamps, woven grass streamers, and other autumn festival decorations honoring the fertile marriage of Thana the Moon and Guyin the Mountain King were ripped from eaves and sent hurtling through flooded streets. At Kal Duchiron Academy, classes were canceled, but work was not. The main gathering hall was filled with pallets of dried and canned food, bottles of purified water, and stacks of plastic tents and blankets. No peak had paid for all the supplies. Academy students divided and packed them into smaller boxes for distribution to people who would need them in the typhoon's aftermath. Green Bones protected and came to the aid of the common people in times of need. It had been that way for as long as there had been Green Bones. Andon cut the plastic wrapping off flats of canned vegetables as the lights shook and water sluiced the dark windows like the inside of a car wash. The campus had a backup generator in case of power outage, but if that failed, they would have to work with headlamps and flashlights. Despite the raging of the elements outside, the conversation inside the hall was animated.
My folks have 2 shops in Sogin, said Heike heatedly, which will be a goddamned war zone. If the mountain can't have the armpit, they'll go after Sogin. I already told them, if things get any worse, it's not worth the risk. You either close up those locations or you eat the cost of double tribute until things sort themselves out.
Going to war with the mountain, muttered Lote, breaking apart jumbo blister packs of batteries.
The calls are out of their minds.
His hands stilled in mid-motion as he glanced over at Andon, so quickly no one else noticed it. Quick defiance flashed across Lote's features. He shifted his gaze away and pushed the hair from his eyes.
Green bones are always bloodthirsty, though. How would we prove who's greener if we didn't look for excuses to fight each other? It's what we're here for, after all, isn't it? To become warriors.
There was a moment of uncomfortable silence from the others. If Lote had spoken in a casual or self-deprecating manner, they might have brushed it off or grumbled some mildly cynical agreement, but his delivery had been too resentful and acidic. Andon dropped his own eyes, his face warming.
That's a narrow way of looking at it,
replied Pau Noni, with some heat of her own. Pau came from a family wealthy and modern enough to have sent not just sons but daughters to the academy, a more common occurrence on Kaycon these days than back in the time when Ait Yu had sent his adopted daughter to be trained in the same manner as her brothers.
Being educated as a green bone opens up opportunities, Pau pointed out. We're part of an honorable tradition. Even if you never fight in a duel,
Once you're a graduate of the academy, you've proven something. No one can take that away from you.
Unless they kill you, Lot replied. If there's a clan war, we'll be expected to fight. We'll be fresh meat for the mountain as soon as we get our jade.
Pal said with a challenge in her voice.
You could also say there's bound to be more chances to move up in the clan, if you're the right sort.
And what if you don't want to be the right sort?
Lot countered.
Go into medicine or teaching then, Heike said. Or become a penitent.
Lot let out a loud, derisive snort and shook his head, yanking apart a plastic package so that heavy batteries clattered out and rolled across the table.
Dudo threw up his hands.
What's left to do? Be a year eight Yomo?
That made everyone chuckle uncomfortably and diffused some of the tension that had been building. A few students dropped out of the academy each year, much to the everlasting shame of their families. But typically, such occurrences happened early in training. Only one person, over a decade ago, had left the academy in his final year and not graduated as a greenbone. His name was still invoked by the instructors with near mythological overtones in harsh cautionary reference to the possibility of spectacular failure and disgrace at the 11th hour. Color rose into Lot's face as he gathered the fallen batteries with quick, stiff movements.
Of course not, he muttered, eyes downcast, though scorn remained in his voice.
Tone coughed deliberately and returned the conversation to the situation between the clans.
Personally, I think it's the Horn that wants war. Kaul Lan doesn't seem the type.
See, that sort of talk is exactly why the Pillar had to take a stand.
Dudo exclaimed.
About fucking time, too. The mountain came after his brother. What did they expect? Good for him, showing everyone that he's as thick-blooded as the old Kaul.
Dudo was a typical academy student. The second son of a prominent Lantern Man family, his elder brother would inherit the family business, while Dudo would wear jade and swear oaths to serve the clan, thus ensuring the family's continued favor and prominence within No Peak. This seemed to suit Dudo fine, as he had no interest in component manufacturing or tact.
Ever since the Torch got old and retired, the other clans assumed No Peak's in decline. They won't pay us respect unless some blood gets spilled once in a while.
The assassination attempt on Kaul Hilo and the ensuing showdown in front of the factory had been the subject of constant conversation at the academy for the past 2 weeks. Everyone, it seemed, had a relative or friend or relative of a friend who was a finger in No Peak and had been there and seen Kaul Lan kill Gom Oben. It gave Anden a strange feeling to know that Gom, the dark, athletic-looking second fist who'd saved him from the Wylon boys outside the Hot Hut, a man with no small amount of jade, was now dead by Lon's hand. Anden stacked cans of wax beans in boxes and stayed out of the discussion, perhaps because he was unlucky enough to have inherited his father's light coloring and foreign eyes. When he remained quiet about clan issues, the other students tended to speak freely around him, forgetting who he was. He was already a mixed-race bastard, the prodigious son of an infamous mother, and, they all suspected, queer. Though how that had, mortifyingly, gotten back to Hilo, Anden still had no idea. At any rate, he wasn't keen to openly advertise the Kaul family's patronage and give his classmates more reason to keep him at a wary distance. Listening now, however, he had to bite back frustration. For once, he wanted to flaunt his status in the clan and speak up, to tell his classmates that they didn't really know the Kauls. Lan and Hilo were human beings with worries and flaws like everyone else, and they were doing the best they could for the clan. No jadeless student had a right to judge them. Certainly not Lok Jin. What did he know? Anden clamped his jaw and moved away from the group to unload another box. Why hadn't he said something to rebuke Lok before Pao and Dudo had? It was his family involved in the war, his cousins, more like his brothers, that Lot had openly disparaged. If Andon had been a call in blood and name, those might have been fighting words. He ought to have demanded an apology, but now it was too late. His lifelong habit of being unassuming and his feelings for Lot Jin had stuck his tongue, and now the moment had passed. The wind outside of the gathering hall roared like an animal in pain. Andon tried to tell himself it was better that he'd kept quiet. There was no call to take any of the talk personally. To most people in John Loon, clan war was like the typhoon outside, a force of nature, something to hide from, endure, bemoan, and remark upon, the deadly toll inevitable and later to be tallied. Out of all of the students in the room discussing the war, to Andon alone was it so personal. He'd heard the news of what happened no sooner than anyone else, passed initially as rumors in the dining hall at breakfast.
"Did you hear? The horn's been shot dead."
Andon had nearly dropped the bowl he'd been carrying. A horrible icy shock and disbelief had flooded him from head to toe. Before he could even turn around to locate the speaker, someone else spoke up.
"That's not true. They tried to kill him, but it was one of his fists that was shot. The horn's still alive, but some of the assassins escaped, and now the calls are going to go after the mountain."
"Where did you hear this?" Andon demanded, his hands shaking. The table of year sixes looked up at him with startled expressions.
"My brother's a finger who patrols the armpit," said the boy who'd just spoken. "I talked to him an hour ago. He said they've been up all night and have just been called to the call house."
The news continued to build into wild speculation and conflicting reports by midday. The pillar and the horn had gone to the factory. Blood had been shed. The residents of the academy had no personal phones in their rooms. It was evening by the time Andon, in a frenzy that everyone seemed to know more about what was going on than he did, managed to get on the phone in the dormitory hallway and call the call house. Kianla gave him the number to reach Hilo at his girlfriend's apartment.
"Don't worry, Andy."
Hilo sounded to be in remarkably good spirits.
"Is there anything I can do?" he asked.
"Can you graduate by tomorrow? No? Then like I said, don't worry."
"How about Lonjen?"
Andon was still having a hard time imagining Lon killing a man in a duel to the death. Not that the pillar wasn't one of the most powerful green bones he knew, but he'd never seemed in need of violence. Lon rarely even raised his voice.
"Kianla said he was out of the house seeing a doctor. Is he all right?"
There was a brief pause on the line before Hilo said, "He's the pillar, Andy. He can handle whatever the mountain throws at us, like he did today. Didn't I say to you there'd be trouble like this? So don't be surprised. Pass your trials is all."
"I will," Andon promised. 6 more months, and I'll be able to help."
"I know, Andy. Relax. I'm counting on it."
When he hung up, he was still edgy and troubled and had a hard time falling asleep that night. All his life, Andon had thought of the calls as near invincible. He could muster nothing but resentment and contempt for his foreign father. Hispanians were all the same, shallow, arrogant, and faithless, and his mother had been a tragedy of poor judgment and insanity that inspired in him a combination of grief, disdain, and horror. The Calls were the family he'd wished he'd been born into. Now, as Andon busied himself in a corner of the gathering hall, stacking finished boxes and not returning to the conversation with Lot and the others, he thought about what had happened to him on boat day. When he'd been taken into Gaunt's car and driven to meet with Ite, he'd been viewed as a call, had been anxiously aware of being a call, and yet also treated like a child and powerless to help in any meaningful way. He felt the same way now. When the typhoon was over, John Loon looked as if it had been power-washed by a horde of clumsy giants.
Trees and electrical poles were knocked down, cars overturned, and some parts of Fishtown, the Forge, and the Temple District were flooded. Andon and his academy classmates spent several days manning relief centers and distributing supplies to people without electricity, running water, or enough food. At times like this, there was peace on the streets. The clans tended to the people of their own territories and helped their lantern men to clean up and rebuild. In disputed or neutral areas, the clans worked alongside each other in unspoken temporary truce. On the afternoon of Autumn Festival itself, Andon found himself clearing debris from the roads in the Temple District. The typhoon had broken the last of the summer heat and cleared the skies into startling smog-free blue. "Happy Autumn Festival!" people shouted to each other, with some sarcasm, as they threw rubble into industrial garbage bins and swept sidewalks. The crowds milling in and out of the district's many houses of worship were smaller than usual, but there were still plenty of chanting and firecrackers to be heard, echoing up and down the neighborhood.
"Let's wheel that bin over there to the curb," Loat said, pointing to a dense tangle of fallen tree branches in the street.
Andon followed Loat, hauling the trash bin behind him. They set it down and worked together, gathering and breaking the splintered wood, filling the container. They did not speak at first. Andon was trying to decide whether to still be angry at Loat for his comments in the gathering hall 2 days ago. If Loat noticed Andon's frequent involuntary glances at him, he did not acknowledge or return them. He seemed absorbed in the current task and distant in his thoughts, his sulky mouth set in a slight frown as his ropey arms tensed, snapping branch after branch. Andon turned away, exasperated with himself, and bent to pick up scattered roof shingles. He did not personally know anyone else who was queer besides Master Teo, the senior perception instructor. Loat, he was not sure about. They were in the same circle of friends, but Andon could not call Loat a friend in a personal sense. They were always together with other people, and Loat had closer companions such as Dudo and Heike, with whom he spent his free time. Andon had never tried to interject himself into their close circle or to be so presumptuous as to seek his classmate out alone. He'd heard Loat express interest in women in the typical casual way, although as far as Andon knew, those had never turned into anything particularly serious. Serious relationships were not easy for anyone to accomplish at the academy, which maintained a traditionally monastic attitude regarding romantic relationships between students, which was to say, it was officially forbidden. Still, there were times when Andon thought he caught something from the other young man, a gaze held over long, a quickness to be on the same side in a game of pickup relay ball, an interest glimpsed in an act as mundane as sharing the task of breaking up and clearing debris from a street. The Kekanese viewed queerness as a natural occurrence in the population, much like stone eyes, and did not blame the person in question any more than one would blame a child for being born deaf. Like stone eyes, though, they were considered unfortunate and unlucky, a sign that a family had fallen into disfavor with the gods, who saw fit to prune the offending lineage as punishment. Andon was not surprised or particularly troubled by this view. He already knew his family was cursed. In general, however, people were uncomfortable around misfortune and reluctant to admit their own. He was certain that some people at the academy tugged their right earlobes behind his back, but glancing at Loat again, watching him pause to draw a forearm over his sweaty brow and stretch his long spine before reaching for another branch, he felt a hurtful pang in his chest to imagine that Loat might be one of them. Abruptly, Loat said,
"I heard about what happened to you on boat day."
Andon was startled. He paused before tossing a chunk of rubble into the bin and wiping his dusty hands on his pants. He hadn't told anyone at the academy about what had happened on boat day, not because he meant to keep it a secret, but because it was not his nature to draw attention to himself. The conversations he'd had with Gaunt and Ite seemed like clan business that Lon and Hilo might not want spread around, so he told his classmates he'd gotten lost in the crowd and made his way back to the academy alone. Lot said, "I heard it from my da." Andon nodded slowly. It had slipped his mind that Lot's father was a high-ranking Fist. It was strange to think he probably answered directly to Hilo.
He was there?
Andon couldn't remember all the men who'd been flanking the horn that day.
"He was disappointed the mountain let you go."
Lot's sulky mouth twisted with black amusement.
"The horn would have gone to war for you," he said. "He would have gotten to storm Littlehammer, win more jade for himself, my da. Had a building surrounded already and everything."
Andon looked away, pulling off his glasses and wiping specks of grit from the lenses to hide his confusion. Whenever he felt he and Lot shared some moment of possible friendship, some connection, no matter how minor, there would be, not long after, something to suggest the complete opposite. This seemed to be one of those instances. Why would Lot tell him such a thing?
"Then I guess your daw is happy now with the war looking so likely," Andon said,
his voice a monotone that did not hide the fact he thought Lot's comment had been in poor taste.
"I didn't even have to die to start it."
Lot smirked.
"Don't take it personal, KK. I don't care what my daw thinks."
He tossed another branch into the trash bin, then leaned against it, his dark eyes climbing over Andon with interest. Andon's pulse gave a skip.
Lot said, "You've got a lot more going on than you let show, don't you? You're more clan than the rest of us, but you stay quiet about it. I can't quite figure out if that's who you really are."
His tone was idly curious, but there was a perplexed intensity to his gaze, perhaps even a touch of anger. Uncomfortably, Andon tried to think of how to answer. From the other side of the intersection, Tone called out,
"Look at that!"
Andon turned around, and his stomach jolted in recognition. A shiny black ZT Valor was driving slowly down the street, towing a flatbed trailer with two mountain greenbones, a man and a woman, sitting perched on the end of it. The car stopped on a street corner and honked. The two greenbones hopped off and began handing out yellow cakes from long aluminum trays crammed with the traditional festive treat. A crowd quickly formed, pressing eagerly but respectfully up to the vehicle.
"Happy Autumn Festival," the greenbones said. "One each, please. Happy Autumn Festival."
The door of the Valor opened, and Gaunt Ash stepped out. Even dressed for the holiday in a white shirt and dark suit, with most of his jade out of sight, his physical presence was such that the throng made room for him at once.
"Thank you, Gaunt-Jen,"
they called, saluting him.
"May the gods shine favor on the mountain."
The horn of the mountain nodded amiably, spoke to some of the crowd, remarked upon the cleanup efforts, and handed out yellow cakes. Andon went back to his work, studiously ignoring the scene, but his jaw was clenched as he broke discarded tree branches over his knee with greater and greater force.
"You four, academy boys," Gaunt's deep voice called. "Come here."
They hesitated, looking at each other, but it would be blatantly impolite not to obey. Tone and Dudo approached, and after another moment of hesitation, Lot and Andon followed. Gaunt handed each of them a yellow cake, warm and soft, freshly baked, smelling of butter and fruit paste.
"For your hard work," said the horn.
Tone, Dudo, and Lot looked down at the cakes in their hands with nervous surprise.
"Thank you, Gaunt-Jen,"
Tone murmured, and the other two echoed him, saluting one-handed as they retreated judiciously. Before Andon could do the same, Gaunt wrapped an arm around his shoulders with the slow weight of a python's coils. He spoke in a low rumble, too near Andon's ear for the others to overhear.
I'm disappointed you didn't accept our offer.
The first time he'd met Gaunt in front of the hot hut in Summer Park, Andon had been intimidated, impressed by the man's powerful and eloquent presence. Now, he thought, Gaunt Ash tried to kill my cousins. He wants to see everyone in the Call family dead. He could feel all the jade on the man's arm, the weight of its dense energy resting across the back of his neck. Andon forced himself to raise his eyes to meet the horns.
I may look Espenian on the outside, Gaunt-chan, he said, but that doesn't mean I can be bribed like a dog.
With no surprise or hint of affront in his voice, Gaunt said,
Today is the autumn festival, and the gods expect us to show generosity. So I will give you some advice, Andon Emery. Don't insult the pillar's regard for you by offending us in the future. It would be a shame for us to be enemies.
Gaunt released Andon and returned to the Valor and its towed cargo of cakes. Andon rejoined his classmates, who were standing on the other side of the street, wiping cake crumbs from their mouths.
What did he say to you?
Lote asked, looking at Andon with even more curious uncertainty than before.
He wished me a happy autumn festival.
Andon stared down at the warm pastry in his hand, but did not feel like eating it. He watched Gaunt's car move down the street.
And he wanted to make it clear that if I become a fist in No Peak, the mountain will make a point of killing me.
Chapter 25 Lines Drawn.
Although the mountain stopped terrorizing No Peak's properties in the armpit, Kal Helo was well aware that his clan had otherwise gained little from the agreement. Their rivals had surrendered the parts of the district that were rightfully No Peak's to begin with, and shrewdly kept control of their stronghold south of Patriot Street, which included John Loon's most profitable betting houses. He could spare neither the time nor the manpower to further bolster their position in the armpit, on account of being diverted by trouble in the docks. The docks, of all places. Undisputed No Peak turf, home to long-standing businesses like the Twice Lucky and the Lilac Divine. A crime spree had erupted. Thieves were raiding transport trailers carrying imported luxury goods and reselling them on the black market. The culprits, as far as anyone could tell, were common street gangs, but the scale and timing of the outbreak were cause for suspicion. Hilo's intuition was confirmed when Ken and his fingers caught three of the thieves who, under persuasion, admitted that a man whose name they didn't know, a man with jade, had provided them with trucking schedules and cargo manifests out of Summer Harbor.
What do we do with them, Hilo-Jen? Ken asked over the phone.
Hilo pulled the metal phone cord as far as it would go, stepping around the corner and turning his back to the nurse wheeling an empty bed down the hospital corridor. He put a hand over the other ear to block out the clatter of wheels on linoleum. In the background of wherever Ken was calling from, he heard cursing, sobbing, and incoherent, muffled noises. Thieves were the most despised kind of criminal on Kaycon. Lifting shipments of watches and handbags normally merited a beating and a branding, but this was different. This had Gaunt Ash's fingerprints on it. The mountain was not above recruiting jadeless criminals to harass No Peak on their behalf.
Kill two of them, let the most talkative one go, Hilo said.
He hung up and went in to see Tar.
Good news, he said. They're telling me you'll be out of here in a couple of days.
Tar was sitting up in bed. Bullets had lacerated his spleen and perforated his bowel. He'd been through surgeries and transfusions. Some of his jade had been removed before he'd gone into the operating room, and he was only now strong enough to be wearing it again, but his aura was as thin and prickly as his mood.
About time. The doctors here don't know shit, and the food is terrible.
I'll have someone bring you something you like. What do you want? You want some takeout noodles? Something spicy?
Anything. I feel a lot better. That green doctor you sent did a good job.
Prized family resource, Hilo said.
Greenbone